This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2023 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us for Socialism 2024, which will be held in Chicago next Labor Day weekend, August 30th through September 2nd. It's never too early to make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Sure. My name is Jason. I'm from Jewish Voice for Peace.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sandra Tamari. I'm based in St. Louis. I'm with the Adala Justice Project. I'm really happy y'all are here.
Hello, my name is Mohammed Al-Kurd. I am from Jerusalem, Palestine. I am a writer, unfortunately. I work as Palestine correspondent for The Nation magazine and as cultural editor for Monde Weiss magazine, and I'm happy to be here. Yay.
Great. So I'm going to start at the beginning. I think one of the questions that doesn't get asked in our movement very often, it's the support that the whole reason that Israel is able to operate on the national stage, despite being as unpopular as it is, has been U.S. support. And the U.S. is so staunchly supportive of Israel and has been for so long that it's taken as a given, that it's sort of like the air that we breathe and that we understand the U.S. is going to be behind Israel. But I think it's actually worth talking about why that is. And that's what I want to center my presentation on, about why the United States supports Israel. Because, you know, the fact that Israel has diplomatic relationships with most of the world is because of the United States. The fact that Israel has, you know, any number of things they do is because of the United States. You know, a recent U.S. Department memo says, Israel is a great partner to the United States, and Israel has no greater friend than the United States. Americans and Israelis are united by our shared commitment to democracy, economic prosperity, and regional security. The unbreakable bond between our two countries has never been stronger. And so, you know, politicians are constantly reinvoking the U.S. commitment to Israel. They brand any criticism of Israel as anti-Semitic. They go above and beyond what is we normally understand for any partner of the United States. And of course, each year, Washington sends $3.8 billion in military aid and $8 billion in loan guarantees. So why is this, right? The mainstream accounts we get are, you know, there's a Holocaust and there needs to be a safe place for Jews and the United States is interested in that. Or, you know, for a long time we heard that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, and so the United States must preserve democracy. You know, obviously, I think that people in this room, we agree that that's not true. But I think that the questions for the left are like, well, but why does the United States support Israel? Some people argue that Washington does whatever Israel wants, that Israel is sort of driving the decisions that Washington makes. I think it's worth saying, you know, here at the Socialism Conference, that the United States is the most powerful capitalist nation in the history of the world. They have the most powerful military in the history of the world. So explaining the actions of the most powerful capitalist power in the history of the world as manipulated by this tiny yet cunning Israel really gets us into like Jews control the world secretly territory, right? And that's not where we want to be, both because it's going to get us destroyed, you know, but it's just false, right? And we want to be clear. We want to be a reality-based movement that understands the world in order to figure out how to change it. So I want to paint like a much simpler picture than all of this cunning and, you know, everything, is that the U.S. and Israel have interests that actually converge in really important ways, right? And I want to talk about a little bit of the political economy. The United States has been a critical sponsor for Israel financially and politically, and Israel has played an invaluable role in helping the United States dominate the Middle East for 70, 80 years. So the story that I'm going to tell is how imperialism and capitalism have underpinned Israel's occupation and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine for over 100 years, so longer than the state of Israel itself. So I'm going to give a bunch of history, and then I'm going to turn it over to my co-panelists to talk about some stuff that is a little more recent. So in the late 19th century, Jews were oppressed across Europe. I mean, we talk about anti-Semitism today, but Jews were oppressed across Europe. The responses within Judaism were varied. A lot of the Jews were part of the socialist movement. People were internationalists. They thought that their liberation was bound up in the liberation of other oppressed groups. Zionism was the opposite ideology of that. Its animating idea was that Jews and non-Jews could never live together. So an exclusively Jewish homeland was necessary. It's a separatist ideology. It's one from that comes from oppression, but it's a separatist ideology that we can never live together, therefore we need to go to our own place. And for decades, am I going too fast, by the way? Okay, I heard someone say yes. I'll slow down a little bit. For decades, Zionism was marginal within Judaism. It's really important to say, like right now we think that Zionism is Judaism, that it is. It was marginal within Judaism. Internationalism or just assimilationism or just, you know, like I don't know what to do was the mainstream, and Zionism was absolutely marginal. Most Jews preferred to work for equality and democracy and to integrate. So the Zionists were faced with this problem. They were a minority of Jews, but they need a homeland, and most of the world is currently, you know, occupied at this time in the early 1900s. So how would the Zionists get their exclusively Jewish homeland? I mean, this is important that Theodor Herzl, who was a leading Zionist at the time, argued that the main aim of Zionism should be to win sponsorship from the great powers for a new Jewish state. So the Zionists appealed to a number of colonial powers, including the Ottoman Empire, who was in control of the Middle East. But the Zionists had, like, you know, they had no money. They had little to offer, except, you know, and so they kept getting refused over and over. So they're trying to shop around. We can be a settler power for you. And they keep getting refused because they have nothing to offer. And then after World War I, Britain was in control of Palestine. And Zionists decided that their best bet was an appeal to London. Chaim Weizmann, who's a Zionist leader working for the British government, he led efforts to convince London that to declare a protectorate and encourage the settlement of European Jews in Palestine, who would defend British interests in the region. A Jewish Palestine, he argued to a British cabinet member, would be a safeguard to England. And the case was well received, right? World War I had revealed to everybody the strategic importance of the Middle East. It surrounded the sea routes to Britain's most important imperial colonies, India, Southeast Asia, and East Africa. It bordered new oil fields in Persia and Egypt, where nationalist movements were beginning to fight to resist British rule. And, importantly, France, which was Britain's greatest rival at the time, was occupying Syria. So the Britain very much wanted to be there and very much needed a force on the ground for them. With the 1917 Balfour Declaration, Britain began supporting the Zionist movement, legitimizing the colonization of Palestine. Jewish immigration to Palestine increased sharply over the next few decades. And unsurprisingly, as colonization increased, so over the next 30 years, so too did violence for Palestinian Jews. And again, I'm sorry, I have to condense a lot of history into a very short amount of time, so I want to encourage people to ask questions or clarify anything that I'm sort of asserting or moving quickly through. So in November of 47, we're now 30 years later, the United Nations authorized partitioning the land in two states. But by May of 1948, Zionist provocations and land grabs led to Jewish-Arab skirmishes that blew up into an all-out battle. And just like today, the violence was incredibly unequal. Like there's a great book that's unfortunately out of print, but if people can find it, it's just wonderful. It's called Intifada, Zionism, Imperialism, and Palestinian Resistance by Phil Marshall. And in it, he quotes someone as saying, "A few thousand ill-directed Arab volunteers faced well-armed Zionist militias prepared by years of training." So it was a bloodbath. And I think other people will cover what happened, but the quote here is, "The Haganah, which is the Zionist military organization, the strategy was to take possession of territory allotted to the Jews under the UN plan and to strike out along routes to isolated Jewish settlements in Arab areas. They quickly took many of the towns and means of communication. In these areas, the Zionist state apparatus was put into place, and on May 14th, David Ben-Gurion proclaimed a state of Israel in the territories under Zionist control." 11 minutes after Ben-Gurion's proclamation, U.S. President Harry Truman recognized the new state of Israel. It was amazing. 11 minutes is fast when you have Twitter, when you have text messages, when you have phones, when you have what? Whatever you have at that time. That's like 11 minutes is fast. It's almost like maybe there were some discussions beforehand. As World War II ended, capitalist competition was rapidly globalizing. So I want to talk about why it's in the United States' interest now to get involved. The U.S. was an emerging superpower after World War II, and it was like eyeing the Middle East's newly discovered and vast oil deposits hungrily, right? A 1945 State Department memo described these deposits as a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. But as much as the U.S. ruling class wanted that oil Invasion and colonization wasn't an option, and this is really important to understand the U.S.-Israeli relationship. That would have required ongoing direct rule, which would have been fantastically difficult and expensive to support from thousands of miles away. When you think about the U.S., how far they are to have aircraft carriers, to have military, et cetera, it would have been completely unpracticable, or it would have bankrupted the United States to try. And in the 1950s and 60s, Arab nationalism was sweeping across the Middle East. President Gamal Abdel Nasser was struggling to throw off British imperialism and unite the Arab countries. So anti-imperialist struggles were erupting across the region, which were threatening to expel all the Western powers. And so these uprisings meant a highly unstable region, which made was like a terrible investment climate for the United States to just come in. And still worse from the American point of view, many of these countries were moving closer to the Soviet Union. So it was a very dangerous place to just sort of intervene directly. So the United States was forced to seek allies in the region. To pull Arab countries into its orbit, it argued like that capitalist democracy was superior to Soviet communism. But in June of 67, and again, I'm skipping, so people should ask if they have questions, but in June of 67, the Six-Day War made it clear to both the United States and Israel that a partnership was a good idea. A central motivation for Arab nationalism was opposition to Israeli intervention in the region. Military tensions rose on both sides of, on all of Israel's borders, until Israel invaded the Jordanian-controlled West Bank. They launched airstrikes over Syria, and they attacked Egypt. Within 6 days, Israel had won like a decisive land war and took control of the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem from Jordan, and the Golan Heights from Syria. Ruthless, powerful, vicious, and effective. Israel had proved its ability to militarily overpower its neighbors, and if made an ally, American power brokers realized the United States could use Israel to exert control indirectly in that region. So the United States quickly replaced Britain and France as Israel's new, more committed imperial sponsor. In the year before the Six-Day War, total U.S. aid to Israel was $23.7 million, which is still a huge sum at that time. But in the year after, U.S. support skyrocketed to $106 million. And every time, in 73, every time there was a massive Israeli attack, the U.S. support would go up. So I'm going to just wrap up real quickly by talking about what these two powers get in return for each other. Washington basically was effectively a U.S. military outpost, and what military strategists determined was the most important region of the world. Like, you know, there's really no price tag too high for what the United States got out of the deal on its own terms. They got an indigenous intelligence service. They got troops that were trained and familiar with the territory. They're ideologically committed to the job, and all the weapons they would ever need right there in the region. And there was no need to convince the U.S. public for a military incursion or to deploy the U.S. military thousands of miles away. People remember that after Vietnam, it was very difficult to convince the U.S. population that the U.S. should go to war. They didn't need to do any of that because Israel was busy doing its work in the Middle East and around the world. And a conservative estimate of the cost to the United States to handle all the things that I just said was at least $125 billion a year. And they're getting that for $106 million a year. It was a bargain for the United States. And it was also a windfall for U.S. defense corporations. I think when we talk about U.S. military aid to Israel, it feels like we're just handing out cash to Israel. But it's much more insidious than that. It's like, when we talk about why the U.S. does this, we talk about who they're responsible to. They're responsible for making sure that U.S. capitalism is staying afloat and growing and growing. So the U.S.-Israeli relationship has been a windfall for U.S. defense corporations. Billions of dollars the United States sends to Israel wind up coming back to the military industry. It's where they buy their weapons from. It's where they buy their planes from. It's where they buy their... for example, a 2010 agreement between the United States and Israel allows for a total of $15.2 billion in military grants from the United States to buy F-35 fighters from Lockheed Martin, and that's just one contract, right? It gives you a sense of how big the relationship is. So the special relationship between the United States is basically one based on geostrategic positioning and the growing interpenetration of the two economies. This is just the beginning. There's other many important moments. I wrote an article for Jacobin called "Why Does the United States Support Israel," which people can check out. There's a bunch of great books, which I'll mention in a little bit. But fundamentally, what I want to end on is that we want to understand not just that the United States supports Israel. What we want to do, especially in Jewish Voice for Peace, we're trying to end U.S. support for Israeli oppression of Palestinians. To do that, we can't just appeal to the better nature of the people who are ruling this country. We have to understand what's happening. And to understand what's happening, you really understand the vastness of of what is at stake. That the U.S. empire around the world has been held in place in many, many ways by their relationship to Israel. So no matter how many times Israel embarrasses the United States, they will still invite a racist like Netanyahu to come to the White House, who's coming in, a month? The relationship will keep continuing until we can disrupt it. And the movement right now is growing, and it's very exciting, but we have to do that with an eye towards what it's actually going to take to end that relationship. Thanks.
Well, that's great, Jason. Thank you for setting the stage for us. I want to do what this is a big task, to do what Edward Said tried to do in 1979 when he wrote an essay about Zionism from the standpoint of its victims. We want to ground ourselves into how this huge imperial project has impacted Palestinians, right? Begin from the very beginning. It's important to remember that Zionism predates the Jewish movement. I mean, Zionism is a British colonial fantasy based in religious, mythology. It's the same mythology that, the U.S. Actors use to displace indigenous people on this land. So we're not talking about anything very complicated. It's an old colonial story. These are land grabs. And people, right? Indigenous people are the victims of this process. And so it's important for us to ground ourselves. There is no way for a Palestinian to be a Zionist. let's just be really clear. Zionism is the ideology, the racist ideology that Palestinians must be removed from their land to make way for a Jewish state. There's no democracy in a state that gets rid of, hundreds of thousands of millions of people to create its electorate, right? So this myth, I hope that one has been put to rest by now, right? Now we have Israelis finally saying it, but only because their rights are being infringed upon, right? And opposing Zionism is supporting Palestinian rights. Plain and clear. There's nothing else involved in it. It's saying we oppose this project, we oppose this colonial project that is going to impose a Palestinian dispossession, that is imposing a Palestinian dispossession. There's nothing anti-Semitic about it. Let's just be very clear, right? Okay. Palestinians didn't just vanish in the air, right? Where did we go? We went anywhere that would take us. Millions ended up in Jordan. Hundreds of thousands ended up in Lebanon. Remain stateless, have very limited rights, cannot work in many professions. We have people in Egypt. We have people in Syria who are the victims of another form of imperialism that's happening to this day. And then many of us made it to the West. Many of us made it anywhere that would take us. I'm going to talk a little bit about my husband's family because they come from the area of Palestine that was occupied in 1948. My husband's family, Steve, hi, was displaced from Palestine in May of 1948 when the U.S. and Israel moved to create the state. What did that entail? So they were from Jaffa, which I think is where Muhammad's family is also from. You're from Haifa. Okay, not far away. From the same coast. So I'd like to, if you will indulge me, I wrote a small essay about this story, about what happened to my father-in-law, Elias, who was 23 when the Nakba happened. 15 days. That is what my father-in-law, Elias, thought when he, his parents, and his brother fled their home in Jaffa, Palestine, in May 1948. The family was terrified. There was shooting everywhere in town. Zionist fighters fired at Uncle Edmond's house down the street. Everyone in the family argued about the next move. Elias's father didn't want to leave, while his mom, Julia, said staying would mean leaving their sons to die. Julia won out. They made the difficult decision to flee to a safer area of Palestine in the West Bank, where they had family. I don't need my winter coat, Elias announced, throwing the heavy garment onto the bed. We'll go back in 15 days. Then he turned the iron black key to lock the door. Those 15 days turned into a lifetime. Elias first went to Ramallah, this is where my family is from, among the fortunate few with a place to go. The family stayed in the cousin's now crowded house. They didn't have to walk to Lebanon or take their chances on small boats tossed into the Mediterranean Sea as so many other Palestinians did. But even still, with these breaks, Elias's father died within months of losing his home and his country. The cause, heartbreak. Elias, a man in his mid-20s, soon set out for Beirut to look for work and a new life. He met American relief workers who sponsored him to come to the United States. A boat called the Homeland delivered him to Ellis Island in New York in 1952. Elias spent the rest of his life working as a relief worker. He lived around the world, absorbing the cultures of places like Bangladesh, the Ivory Coast, and Haiti. Everywhere he went, he carried his Palestinian sense of family and hospitality with him, flashing his biggest smile whenever he heard Creole in a cafe or in a store. He would identify the home village and name a dozen relatives of Haitians that he met on the street. Elias never stopped telling us stories about his beloved Yaffa. He could name every family that had lived in that neighborhood and made sure his grandchildren, my kids, knew that Palestine, and in Palestine, that he had a pet donkey and that there used to be a piano in the living room. When Elias was nearly 90 years old, we brought him home. He was only a tourist, because that's the only way that he could enter, and he had a U.S. passport. That's the only reason why he was allowed to visit. But we took him to see the house that had been stolen from him. He guided us to the neighborhood and walked up to the door. It was unlocked. Elias entered the house he hadn't seen in over 60 years. The Jewish-Israeli woman in the house wasn't scared, but very curious. And she allowed us in. Elias was saddened that his mother's beloved fruit trees were no longer in the garden. Though we left after a few minutes, we are returning. So I just want to, like, thank you. So when people ask you, what do Palestinians want, it's that simple. We want to go home. Okay.
Thank you. Hey, what's up? Are you all awake and good and ready? There's 10 more minutes of this. And I'm going to be all over the place because there's an Adderall shortage. Type. I will be very brief, and obviously there's people are coming into this session from different backgrounds and people have different understandings. What Sandra talked about, the Nakba, as some of you may know, as most of you should know, it continues until this day. And I want to talk about the mechanisms in which the Nakba manifests today on the ground in various locales. I'm going to talk about four locales. And the reason why I want to do this is because I want to show you that it is intrinsically connected to you as Americans or as people who live in this country. Obviously, I'm not going to cover the entire universe in 10 minutes, so I invite everyone, I beseech you, which is a word I just learned, to ask the dumbest questions. This is a safe space. Usually, I'm very flippant, but today I'm going to answer all the questions. I think it's really important to meet people where they are. So without further ado, I grew up in a neighborhood in Jerusalem called Sheikh Jarrah. And my earliest memories in the house was having somebody with what I later learned was a New York accent come knock on our door and tell us that our house, my grandmother's house, was now his. My grandmother was born and raised in Jerusalem, but she married into Haifa, and she lived in Haifa. She lived a comfortable life until the Nakba happened, and she was forced out of her home. And then she moved from city to city, until she settled in a neighborhood called Sheikh Jarrah in the eastern part of occupied Jerusalem. The neighborhood was built as a refugee housing project by the United Nations and the Jordanian government, which had control over the eastern part of Jerusalem at the time. And her and 28 other families lived there until in the 70s, Jewish settler organizations started claiming their houses as theirs. So Sheikh Jarrah is the first locale I'm going to be looking at. The way in which the Nakba manifests in Sheikh Jarrah is through fabricated real estate disputes. I'm sure you've heard this term, eviction, all over the news when talking about Palestinian families that are at risk of losing their homes, but the term itself carries so little of the connotations that are actually implied on the ground. What is happening to our families in Sheikh Jarrah is not some legal authority or some landlord evicting us for not paying rent for a few months. It's not somebody that has any kind of legal jurisdiction over our families. It's much, much more violent, and it's an act of expulsion that involves hundreds of soldiers, hundreds of armed settlers who often come from all over the world. In the case of my family, the settler that is squatting in our home is from Long Island in New York. He has fraud charges, and he, through some legal loophole, has managed to seek refuge in the Israeli regime and is now squatting in our home. Such is the case, obviously, with many other families. Now, I don't want to imply that eviction itself is not violent. What I want to imply is that eviction here suggests that there is some kind of legal authority that in reality does not exist, particularly over the eastern part of Jerusalem, which is under occupation according to international law, according to all the good people and the bad people. Like, this is something that everybody agrees on. In 2009, after, you know, decades and decades and decades of going to the courts, of battling these settlers and settler organizations, I came home from school to find that all of our furniture was scattered all across the street. And then our neighbors had the same experience happen to them. And then fast forward to the year 2020, this was still going on. The second half of our home was also at risk of being taken. We did a campaign. The campaign was kind of successful. Whatever, I'm not going to talk about this right now. We don't have time. You can ask about it. But this is just one way, right? The idea that they are using real estate disputes to sue people out of their homes. The organization that is involved in my neighborhood, actually there's a few. There's one called Nachalat Shamon, and there's one called the Israel Land Fund. Now, the Israel Land Fund does exactly this, and you'd think this is like a niche organization, but in fact it was established by Jerusalem's deputy mayor, Aria King. So you can already see that the link between the state and the settler movement. We're not just talking about settlers utilizing an asymmetrical, a racist, a discriminatory judicial system, but literal members of the government are taking settlements into their own hands. And when we're thinking about expulsion in Palestine, we must remind ourselves that this is a judiciary that was built by settlers for settlers, for the purpose of bureaucratizing and facilitating the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. Now, the reason I mentioned these organizations, you don't need to remember their names, but you do need to remember that the entirety of their operating budgets come from New York State, and they are subsidized by Zionist organizations that enjoy tax-exempt status in New York State. We'll talk about this in a little bit. Now, another example I want to use is Silwan. Silwan is a neighborhood just 10 minutes from my neighborhood, 5 minutes if you're a terrible driver. And you have about 1,000 people whose homes are threatened with demolition. If you're looking at American news, you would see, well, these people build their houses without permits. Sucks for them, but they should get a permit, and then no one would demolish their home, right? The fact of the matter is, what these newspapers do not tell you is that 93% of building permit applications submitted by Palestinians in Jerusalem are rejected, and the percentage is nearly 100% in the West Bank. Not only this, not only do they reject any and every building permit, not only do they prevent us from the natural community expansion that any community should be able to enjoy, but the man himself responsible for approving and rejecting these building permits, his name is Yonatan Youssef, and he himself is a self-proclaimed settler activist. He has wandered the streets of Sheikh Jarrah with a megaphone screaming Islamophobic slurs. He has vandalized murals of solidarity that we have in our neighborhood. And he has walked around just last month in our neighborhood with a megaphone, with a crew of settlers, talking, chanting, saying, we want Nakba today, we want another Nakba. So again, you see the intrinsic link between the settler movement and the state, and you see that they are one and the same in the case of Sheikh Jarrah and in the case of Silwan. Another example I want to use is Masafer Yatta. Masafer Yatta, or the South Hebron Hills, is a community of Bedouins or cave dwellers, Palestinians, who have lived in the West Bank for decades. They have cultivated their lands for decades. They have taken care of their animals, or whatever the verb is, for decades. And now they are being expelled from their homes. They are being thrown out of their homes. Again, if you're looking at American newspapers, if you're looking at French newspapers, you would see the headline, Palestinians living in a firing zone, evicted, right? So you think, in your head, you think it's such a shame that these Palestinians are being evicted, but they shouldn't have built their houses in a military zone, in an off-limits zone. Why would you build your house in a firing zone? Again, what these newspapers do not tell you is that these firing zones were created by design by the Israeli government for the sole purpose of expelling these communities, right? These communities that predate not only Israel, but predate Zionism, that have lived in Hebron for the longest time. Just one day, Ariel Sharon, the former Israeli prime minister, but he was the minister of agriculture at the time, decided that he's going to declare these lands off limits and that everybody living in them is going to have to flee their homes. And they have been, the Israelis have been successful to a certain degree in recent months. Now, not only are these firing zones created for the sole purpose of, expelling people. And by the way, this is not some kind of a conspiracy theory, although a huge fan of conspiracy theories. This is not a conspiracy theory. These are according to minutes that were leaked from the Israeli, or like declassified from the Israeli state archive, that showcase Israeli politicians saying it verbatim, that this is, they are declaring military zones for the sole reason of expelling Palestinians. Now, if that's not bad enough, the judge, the Supreme Court judge, who gets to rule or who gets to decide whether or not these communities should stay in their homes, is himself a settler in the West Bank, right? Not even by my own definition of settlers, as in people who came from Europe and settled in Palestine, but no, settler according to international law, living in an illegal settlement, right? This is the man who holds the gavel, who decides to call the shots. So again, when we're talking about a judiciary in this context, not only is it asymmetrical, but it is ideologically driven, it is expansionist, and it is built on this. Now, the final example, I don't know how long I've been talking. You following? Yeah? It's fine, you're going to have to listen to it. The last community I want to talk about, and there's plenty more, al-fikra, but the last community I'm going to talk about is al-Naqab. Very briefly, you have the desert in the south of Palestine, and you have these communities that are being kicked out of their homes. But actually, if you read the news, you would see that the Jewish National Fund, which is a beautiful charity organization that you donate to so they can plant trees, is relocating them with some force so that they can plant trees in the desert and they can make the desert bloom like they have been doing since I was born. But the reality is not this, right? The reality is that they're using planting trees, afforestation, as a guise for expelling people from their homes. Again, we're talking about communities that have had claim to their lands, that have owned their lands and cultivated their lands for generations and generations and generations. And much like the case in our ownership documents in Sheikh Jarrah, much like the case in Masafer Yatta, much like the case in Silwan, much like the case in the Naqab, the ownership documents get tossed out by the court. Right? Why is any of this important? because it is subsidized by your tax dollars, one way or the other. What allows the Jewish National Fund to plant trees and to plant forests that cover the ruins of a massacre is American donations. Recently, there has been a campaign launched in the United States, in New York State, called Not on Our Dime. This campaign seeks to target and repel the tax-exempt status from New York-based charities who send an annual $60 million to various settler organizations. And again, we're not talking about niche or fringe or marginal organizations. We're talking about organizations that have been started by politicians. For example, Regavim, the organization that operates both in Naqab and in Masafer Yatta, was established by Bezalel Smotrich, who is now the Israeli prime minister, the Israeli finance minister, who you may have heard of because of some outlandish things he said, like the Palestinians don't exist, or that they should wipe out an entire Palestinian town, and so on and so forth. And he is also he's a self-proclaimed fascist homophobe, which is something you can call yourself now, if you want. I was going to talk a little bit about resistance, but I think I've wandered off a little bit, so we're just going to keep it at expulsion. I hope what I said kind of illustrated to you how expulsion really operates. This is not some kind of past tense act that is happening, that is long gone. This is not a relic. This is not something we mourn and grieve and commemorate. This is something that is happening actively, and it's happening in various ways, and it is complicated by design, and it is undeniably connected to everybody here in this room. I say this because I want your support and solidarity for Palestine to transcend identitarian sentiment. I want it to transcend just symbolism. I want you to not only have the right sentiment, but I want you to localize the struggle. Look at your workplace, look in your communities, at your schools. Find ways you can support Palestinians. Find ways you can cut ties with the Israeli occupation, because it's cool and cute to like wear hummus, eat hummus and wear keffiyehs and sing, you know, Ana Dami Falastini and eat falafel and all that shit. But we need material support on every possible front. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.